Emma Kelly Inoue from Kyoto University. Sorry. First of all, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to attend this exciting meeting and even to give a talk. Today I'm going to talk about what the title says, but this title is only for the third part of the talk. Before that, I will give hopefully a short overview of the evolution of multicellular organisms. I'm not an evolutionary biologist at all, and so I couldn't dare to put evolution to my title. So the first part is just a general introduction, standard way of understanding the first appearance of multicellularity. And this part owes much to the writings by John Bonner and Dale Kaiser and David Kirk. First, a multicellular organism, as it says, it's rather difficult. A multicellular organism is one in which the activities of the individual cells are coordinated, and the cells themselves are either in contact or close enough to interact strongly. Well, there will be many definitions, but loosely, I would think multicellularity in this way. To be honest, unicellular, the distinction between unicellular organism and multicellular organism does not seem to me to be so very clear. For example, multinucleate large, say, cell, should it be called a single cell or something different? I think, there must be some more clear definition, including those sensitive like things, or like plants. For instance, today's land plants are, in a sense, very large multinucleate cell. So that's my honest feeling, and I'd like to have some response from you, more professional evolutionary biologists. Anyway, a possible advantage of being multicellular over being unicellular would be, one can think of several things. The first coming to mind would be increase in size. And from it, there will be many things derived, such as new niche, exploring new niche of protection, better protection or more efficient predation. And also internal environment, stable internal environment, and the division of labor among cells, and probably many more. On the other hand, it seems less attention has been paid to the necessary conditions for becoming multicellular. Perhaps cell adhesion, the ability to make cell adhesion, or ability, or cell signaling, or cell differentiation. But these activities are not strictly limited to mouse cellular organisms. Furthermore, it is not obvious whether these properties are possessed by all mouse cellular organisms, either existing or extinct. And this slide shows so-called tree of life drawn based on sequenced organisms. These yellow marks show roughly show the branches where mouse cellular organisms are recognized in the present day Earth. Here is down here. First of all, this wide range, blue range, is Eubacteria, and this small blue part is Archaea, and this pinkish position is Eukaryotes. And in prokaryotes, there's Cyanobacteria and Myxobacteria that have attained cellularity. And in eukaryote, there are many. This large part is metazoa. Here, metazoa, and many other. This picture is too crude to show different taxa independently. So first, I will take these two prokaryotes as example to show some selective forces and advantage of becoming mouse cellular. First, cyanobacteria. It is believed that cyanobacteria is the first on Earth to be attaining mouse cellularity. The top photograph shows a filament cyanobacteria, and the bottom shows a unicellular one. In this kind, filamentous cyanobacteria, probably it is believed that the selecting force derives from the use of nitrogen. As you all know, cyanobacteria does photosynthesis, so they can do carbon fixation. In addition to carbon fixation, some of the cyanobacteria started to make use of atmospheric nitrogen, perhaps. But the problem is that carbon fixation and nitrogen fixation are incompatible because nitrogenase is oxygen sensitive. Perhaps doing nitrogen fixation at night would be enough in the beginning, but in the course of evolution, they evolved the mechanism of separating these two activities temporarily. Then that became the circadian rhythm. As Albert I mentioned the day before yesterday, was cyanobacteria as the ability of circadian rhythm. And the mechanism of cyanobacteria circadian rhythm reside on the multiple feedback loops centered around the core of the chi ABC phosphorylation, dephosphorylation cycle, as shown here. And around that, there are many feedback loops, mostly transcriptional feedback loops. And this picture shows just an example. This is a chi ABC activity. This shows chi ABC activity over 6-7 days. In constant light condition. And as these different symbols showed, different strains, actually mutants, the black is wild type. This shows the circadian rhythm is strictly genetically controlled. By the way, when the first circadian rhythm arose, the day length was not 24 hours. Because the rate of the period of rotation of Earth was much shorter, something like 15-16 hours. I'm not very sure. So the period also became longer, over maybe 2-3 billion years. In this kind of filamentous cyanobacteria, you can see there are some different cells distributed, scattered along the filaments. And the majority of the cells are vegetative cells. They are photosynthesizing, that is, CO2 fixation capable cells. Whereas these darker looking cells which are a bit larger are called heterocysts. They are specialized in nitrogen fixation. These heterocysts, doing nitrogen fixation, transport fixed nitrogen in the form of glutamine to the neighboring vegetative cells. And they receive organic carbon, which these vegetative cells made, and reductant, reducing power from the vegetative cells. Well, this picture is not very good for this purpose, but these heterocysts show very regular patterns. Regular, non-random pattern, equidistant pattern, which would be optimal, which would be an optimal pattern for the interdependence between the two cell types. So there must be some negative feedback mechanism. Wilcox and others has done a lot of experiments to prove the presence of negative feedback mechanisms. And later, some molecular identity has been found. For instance, negative feedback signal seems to be encoded by the gene called PAT-S. So this regular pattern indicates that there is a really real one-dimensional pattern formation mechanism by regulated cell differentiation in this organism. Of course, it is not clear when this kind of regulation appeared first. This is only sure about the present day cyanobacteria. The next example is mixobacteria. mixed bacteria forms fruiting bodies, as shown here, and they make different shapes, different types of fruiting bodies depending on species. Such fruiting bodies are formed by aggregation of thin bacterial cells, like cellular slime molds. It has been established that exhaustion of food induces the transition from feeding phase to fruiting phase. And what is good about making such fruiting body? Del Kaiser proposed that it would be advantageous for them because these mixed bacteria make cooperated feeding. They degrade organic particles by secreted enzymes. So it would be more efficient if more like cells are in the same place. And by making such fruiting bodies, first of all, fruiting body formation is induced by exhaustion of food. When new food supply comes, then they immediately, spores immediately hatch and start doing coordinated feeding together. So that would be one advantage, he argues. But one other advantage would be, like other microorganisms, efficient dispersal of spores. So the development of Myxococcus can be summarized in a very simplified way, like this. It is induced by starvation. Del Kaiser's group has shown that there are intercellular communication going on to regulate the process of fruiting body formation. The first signal is, here I wrote early signal, which is quorum sensing signal. That means the signal ensures that there are many enough cells, starved cells around, so that making efforts to make fruiting bodies will be rewarding. Otherwise, since food supply will be local, so not uniform, so some cells become temporarily starved and some cells keep eating more. So to gather many cells, then it would be more convenient to have such signals. And then this allows starved cells aggregate. And the late signal comes later. This is needed for fruiting and sporulation. So this signal ensures that only cells within that participated in fruiting body formation become spores. Not those cells remaining outside. So basically, there are these signals to regulate fruiting body formation. All right. So from these examples, we could say that some sort of collective activities might be needed to evolve multicellularity for single-celled organisms. Now, in the next part, I will show briefly the multicellular evolution by motile cells. I'm not talking about cells with cell walls, like plants and algae. So I take three examples: bulbs, which moves by flagella beating, and ciliates. I mean ciliates, which moves by cilia, and acrasses, which move by pseudopodia. And just to locate these three organisms in the eukaryotic tree of life, here is metazoa, including the humans. And here's a green alga, bulbox, comes something here, like here. And ciliates is here, and acrasis comes here. So they are quite separate on the tree, on the phylogenetic tree. And psilocybin is here. The first bulbox. This is the most advanced form of bulbox, which consists of more than 1,000 cells forming a shell of single cell thickness, forming a sphere. And these darker, big, relatively big circles are germ cells. So there is germosomal differentiation already existing in this organism. And it is believed that Volvox evolved from a chlamydomonas-like unicellular organism. And there are many intermediate forms existing today. So this Volvox, the characteristics of the Volvox is they have many cells inside, and there is division labor, except for some simple forms, and coordinate cell movement. There are many very, very interesting aspects about the evolution of Volvox, I have no time to go into it. Just pointing out just one thing: that the Chlamydomonas swims by beating the two flagella coming out from one end of the cell and beating them in opposite direction, like breaststroke, so like this. On the other hand, in Volvox, that way of beating will not do, because the cells are on the surface. Looking outside, we're looking, meaning there is an eye spot at the base of the flagella. So this Chlamydomonas shows phototaxis, and Volvox too. And Volvox, this multicellular round thing, also has to move. Otherwise, they will sink and will not catch light effectively. So they have to swim, but they can't swim well if their flagella beat the same way as Chlamydomonas. So in the course of development and also evolution, probably each cell change its structure so that the two flagella beat in the same side, in the same direction, so that on the surface of this Volvox, all the flagella beat in a way that the whole thing move in one direction. Actually, there is a portable axis. So the flagella has to do this same movement as the whole organism. So each individual cell has to do the something like rowing a big boat with the flagella in the same way, not like in the chlamydia mass. So there must be very tight intercellular interaction. The next example is ciliates. It seems rather improbable to think that ciliates, covered with very many cilia all over, can make a multicellular body. But this species, called the Sorogen, has somehow managed it. So this is a fruiting body, again, formed by this ciliate. So this is an individual cell. You can see rows of many cilia here. And this is a magnification of the stalk. The stalk is made of secreted material. And as you might expect, these ciliate cells do not really move by themselves to go up to the top of the fruiting body. It seems the stalk material, some property change make the cell mass rise to give rise to this kind of shape. So this shows that diagrammatically the process of stalk fruiting body formation of this organism. So all the cells trapped in the mucous substance, they secrete themselves, are sort of lifted up on top of the stalk. The next example is acrasis. Since this organism move do not have cilia or flagella, so this moves by extended pseudopodia. And this is somewhat related to my later argument. I showed their movement a little more in detail. So this is the tip of the fruiting body, and these are spores, and they germinate from the spores. So these are all empty spores, and the spores keep coming out. And this is much lower magnification and high speed. So these small dots are individual cells. They somehow aggregate, apparently without chemotaxis, and form such branched fruiting body. And this shows the process of fruiting body formation in detail. Unlike the case of Sorogena, the stalk is made of cells. And it's hard to see inside, what's going inside, but it is almost evident that cells are motile until they sporulate. So they can, and probably you can see that in this stage, there's a large bubbles, three-dimensional mass of cells. They can move in such cell mass, within such cell mass. And this picture shows a starved cells at high magnification. So this looks a bit different from what Gopal showed in the previous talk. So those aphrasis south, aphrasis south, so move very fast with a very large, round protrusion, which is sometimes called lobopodia, like a lobe. So just please remember the way they move. I will come back to this point later. So to make a complex form of multicellular tissues, cells may need to be capable of pseudopodial movement rather than ciliate or flagellar movement. Of course, it is not very certain. Just a case. But pseudopodial movement is sufficient. Is it sufficient? So current knowledge of the mechanism of cell locomotion is largely based on studies of cells firmly attached to a solid surface. In metazoa is multicellular animals, most cells are tightly packed to form tissues. Well, you may have you may not agree, but globally looked, the body of large metazoa appear to be made of a two-dimensional sheet of cells folded in a very complex way. But locally, cell movement in three-dimensional environment is common, especially during early embryogenesis. I'm not sure, people often say that such movement is also common in metastasis or wound healing, but it depends on the type of metastasis or wound healing. So here arise several questions. The first, can cells not move on another cell until the extracellular matrix is formed? Well, in adult animal like human body, extracellular matrix is everywhere. But in development, it may not be so. And second, call this ECM, simply ECM, extracellular matrix. ECM always rigid enough to support massive cell movement? And if so, wouldn't it be an obstacle of cell movement in the 3D situation, three-dimensional situation? Of course, as Gopal said, present day metazoan cells, which want to move around in the tissue, secret enzymes such as metalloprotease to disrupt the ECM so that they can move, but it's not very clear if that is very general property. And fourth, how did cells move before the invention of rigid ECM in evolution? Probably one can imagine that in the early time of multicellular evolution, especially in metazoan evolution, they probably may not have very developed ECM as you see in human or mice like that. So cell movement in tightly packed three-dimensional tissues are different from the movement of solitary cells in the following two aspects. Well, I missed one sentence before this. So just going back, since I have these questions, I thought it would be worth thinking of the possibility, examining the possibility of cells moving in the three-dimensional tissues without the ECM. Then I can say this. The two aspects are, first, the substratum of movement is the neighboring cells, which may also be moving in the same way, in the same direction or in another direction. The second, there are strong constraints on the direction of pseudopod extension because the space is filled with cells inside the tissue. So there arise more questions. Do cells located deep in a closely packed tissue move with the same mechanism as solitary cells? And how do they get traction from their movement, traction for their movement? And how is the force they generate transmitted to the outside of the tissue? Third, how does chemotaxis work in a tissue? Well, I think the first two is more important, but the other three are also interesting. The fourth, does a coherent movement of cells require a mechanism to organize the movement? The fifth, how does the rearrangement of cells, which we call cell sorting, occur in a closely packed tissue? It will be very difficult for a cell to change position when every side is filled with somebody else. So if you had to move one cell distance forward relative to the whole cell tissue, then somebody in the front must make a space. And for it to do that, somebody else will also have to move around. But this kind of thing, as far as I know, has not been examined seriously before. This fourth point is maybe interesting to some, but I will not come back to this question in this talk. So just let me point out that, well, intuitively, there will be only three ways of steady movement in three-dimensional cases, which is just parallel movement, or all the cells move in the same direction, or just uniform circular round movement, and the combination of the two, that is spiral movement. All these three are very common in, for instance, in slime mold development. So I feel that such spiral movement, often seen in slime mold development, muscle development, may not need such spiral signals, which are often supposed to exist. If I'm wrong, please correct me. So now comes the main part of my talk. I already used up 39 minutes. So the cellular slime mold has, like a glacier, unicellular and multicellular stages in its normal life cycle. Multicellular structures can be dissociated into single cells without visibly affecting their motility, and the genome sequence is available in more than 5 species. At the moment, I have only 6, but probably several more somewhere. For these reasons, thus, cellular slime mold would be a very suitable objective to study such things. Already, several people have shown slime mold, pictures of slime molds. But, well, from here, well, I will show you many videos. So this is partly for entertainment. So please feel relaxed. This is simply germination. So cells germinate from a spore. And these sausage-like things are bacteria. So germinate the slime cells. Immediately start to eat it. So this is aggregation. This is isolation plate from the wild, so there are many still bacteria, which presumably this slime mold didn't like to eat. And this is partial view of such aggregation of different species. This is clean. But these white, almost conspicuous structure you see here are contractile vacuoles. You will see a nucleus here. So this gray patch is nucleus. Now this shows aggregation field in a low magnification. Perhaps you can see some weird patterns going out from the center, each center of aggregation. Just taking difference of the two successive frames, you can have this pattern, which is very much like the Betelsos-Jabotinsky wave pattern. Well, why you can see such pattern? So those cells reacting the chemotaxis signals, and which is shown in this white triangle, and those that are non-responsive in the non-responsive period take different shapes, slightly different shapes. But globally, you can see this slight difference as such. Dark light pattern. So this is the process of slough formation. Does this affect? No. The reason this slough go this way is there's a light source in this direction. So yeah. So many, I'm not very sure if it's really many, but probably more than half of the known slime species show very strong phototaxis. So this is another species. So this last one is the genus Polyspontium. This previous one is Dictyostium. And they use different chemoattractant for aggregation. The Dictyostium, so-called the fourth group, uses cyclic KP, which was shown many years ago. And Polyspontium uses a dipeptide called glorine, which was the structure of which was determined by Shimomura, who is the discoverer of equilibrium and GFP. So it's a bit difficult to see, but this is really dipeptide, glutamate and ornithine, making a lacton ring. And the slug of Dictyostelium discoidium has a clear differentiation pattern, pre-stalk and pre-spore, as shown here,
by vital staining with a basic dye neutral red. Well, I'll skip this. And this shows the process of floating body formation in more detail. Here, they are still amoeboid. And at this moment, when this part becomes suddenly opaque, that reflects conversion of pre-spore cells, amoeboid pre-spore cells, into spores. So they lose cell adhesion, and the entire pre-spore region becomes round, because the surface tension now dominates the shape determination. So, yes?
So this elongation, this is very rapid, this elongation of this whatever filament or stalk, this is due to the rapid cell division or the basic processing?
As I'm going to say, the whole process is like mixobacteria induced by starvation. And there are not much cell division going on. So this elongation of the stalk is because of the pre-stalk cells becoming stalk cells at the tip. So the pre-stalk cells pile up on top of the already made stalk. That is one factor. And the other factor is vacuolar expansion. The volume of individual cells become much larger during this process. All right. So like I did with mixobacteria, now, development of the cellular slide mode is induced by starvation, and there are early signals and late signals. Now, there is one more signal here. Early signals, actually, there are many signals. One is quorum sensing signal, and there are some others. These are also very interesting. Cell communication system from the viewpoint of evolution as well. And I am now mostly working, maybe half time working on this process, but I'm not going into that today. So the next is aggregation signals, which is chemotaxis. And the late signal is like my mixobacteria. Signal inducing differentiation, fruiting and differentiation. Before starvation, there is also intercellular communication. One thing is, unlike mixed bacteria, slime mold cells engulf the prey. They do not secrete digestive enzymes. So it makes more sense if they disperse rather than come together to explore more food. So there is John Bonner, video pointed me out, even before John Bonner, Samuel showed that there is negative chemotaxis in nictitous slime. Now, using this slime mold developmental system, I will briefly summarize the point I made earlier, which is the difference between the way of cell movement in two-dimensional and three-dimensional circumstances. This is a sort of conclusion. And mode, there are at least two modes of protrusion extension So this conclusion came from many different observations and analysis, some of which I will show you in a time. So there are two modes of extension. One is actin polymerization mode. The other is tail contraction mode. And there are at least two types of cell locomotion. One is crawling movement, and the other is what I call the gliding movement. So I'm going to show what these mean. So one, the first, crawling movement. This is a movement of vegetative discoidium cells. So this phase contrast image overlapped with fluorescence showing filamentous actin. This is on the actin filaments shown. So basically, well, this looks quite different from what Gopal showed before with the animal cells. But if you look at the fluorescent pattern being concentrated in the leading front of the moving cell, and relatively scarce fluorescence in the rear, there's similarity between this and cultured animal cells. And there are also fixed foot actin rich point. You can see. On the other hand, gliding movement. By gliding movement, I mean something like this. This is also vegetative cells. Very rarely you may see such cell movement of vegetative cells. Sorry, I cannot.
Could you articulate the difference between this and crawling, except for the fact that the second one is less crowded?
This is one difference. This shows, again, actin filament, distribution of actin filaments in moving cells. This is gliding cells. As you can see, actin filaments are more dense in the posterior and scarce in the leading edge. This is only one example. And for instance, inhibition of actin polymerization enhance this type of cell movement, whereas acceleration of actin polymerization tend to suppress this type of movement. So actin polymerization in the front is clearly not the cause of this type of movement. This is another example. This is a cell dissociate from a slug, a mass cell stage. Just starting from here. So this cell is trying hard to moving apart from the rest of the cells, but it is stuck at its the back. But once it's released, it starts moving very fast. The other big difference between the crawling cells and gliding cells. The cells is their speed. Gliding movement is much faster. Nearly, in some cases, 1 micrometer per second. When this is sort of trapped, this is an actin filament again. Actin filament moves backwards with respect to the cell body. When it released, well, as you can see, this axiom filaments flow backwards when it is trapped. But once it released, it now, so this backward flow is not restricted to gliding movement. All cell movement show this backward movement. But here, when this cell is moving forward, you can see active filaments to be stationary with respect to the substratum. So this remains stationary. In fact, it is not really stationary. It moves a little bit backward. That's because when this starts moving, this cell is not adhered to anything. It gets traction from the viscosity of the water, thin layer of water. So this is a dissociated slug cells. Dissociated slug cells always move this way, very fast. And as you might remember, the cell movement, starved acrasis cell move in a similar way as this. And also, perhaps you notice that this cell, the head of this cell sort of fluctuate from side to side. It is actually not a side-to-side movement, but a rotating movement about its longitudinal axis. So there's something rotating in its head. Yes?
What's the advantage of dissociating?
Advantage? Oh, just dissociation. This is simply because how they move when they are dissociated. So I wanted to see what ability they have. In tissues, they are packed and they are forced to take some shape to fill the space. But when released free, you never know what they would do unless doing this kind of experiment. Well, that's that, simply.
Do cells dissociate from the slug in nature?
In many species, probably not, unless they are disturbed by something else. In one species, it is known, in the polycephalon, it is known that they dissociate themselves sometimes. But usually not, I suppose. This is purely to see how they behave under such conditions. All right. So since I'm not showing any data or analytical data, just only visual things. So you may feel frustrated, some of you. But, yes?
The cells which are getting dissociated from the slug, do they have a different movement if they are from the free slug or the free spore?
Yes, it seems, but the difference is much smaller if it exists ever compared to the difference between the slug cells and earlier cells. Right.
Okay, one question.
Yes.
So that's the complete slug, which is not being cut at the tip, shows this characteristic right hand turn, or just the tip shows the characteristic right hand turn?
Complete, meaning before. before was dissociation. Well, actually, to make things simple, I said the slug, but it can be a mount or whatever after they make multiple multicellular body. There may be some subtle differences, but I have never looked into it. Maybe a little bit of more, just not just observation, but a little bit more detail in it. Now this is also a slug, part of the slug. The entire slug is moving in that way. And here you see myosin II, it is a Jeffrey myosin II expressing the slug. And what you are seeing is their surface. As you can see, you clearly see myosin thick filaments, which are stationary with respect to the substrate. They stay where they are up to the point they become the very most part of the cell, each cell. Yes. Sorry, this is sort of the difference in the expression. The transformance is probably not good enough. So some cells do not express the mark of myosin strong enough. And this is a chymograph, time and space plot. You take some line like this, and pile up on top of each other. So time goes this way and space goes this way. This shows that cells move in this direction, whereas myosin, the vertical lines indicate that thing is stationary with respect to space. So as you can see, myosin stays there. This is the actin filaments. As you probably can see, maybe a bit dark. Actin filaments, the pattern of actin filaments remain there, like wallpaper, pattern of wallpaper. So the cell move, but the actin stay there. Alright. You can see the same plots as before, the space and time. So vertical, meaning stationary. Alright. This is a mutant. There are really many actin, F-actin binding proteins, and this is one of it. Tadin, by the way, is in mammalian cells, in animals, is a focal adhesion protein, one of the focal adhesion proteins. And because it's a large size, it is thought to be a particularly important component of focal adhesions. It binds to filamentous actin and on one end, on the one end, and on the other end to integrin beta's cytoplasmic tail. So from the mutant that could not make multicellular morphogenesis, we identify a gene called Talin B, coding for Talin B. And by knocking out this gene, then introducing F-actin marker, you can see such behavior of filamentous actin. There are many more dark patches here. So this is because with this mutant alone, as I said, they cannot make slugs. They cannot do morphogenesis. So you have to mix them with wild-type cells. So this black part is actually filled with wild-type cells. The only mutants are seen. And as you may see, the filamentous actin in this mutant do not stay stationary, but move around rather vigorously. And that can be seen in the same plot as before. Unlike the wild-type case, this F-actin do not form vertical lines, but turn round and round. That shows filamentous actin do not fix on the cortical, to the cell membrane. So telling me, this is the 12th picture of slug cells. Telling is present on the cortical under surface of the cell membrane. So it seems you can distinguish the two different ways of cell movement by knocking out telling B. There will be many more ways, but we know that telling B is necessary for the second kind of cell movement. The telling B, if it is called telling B, there must be telling A. So telling A is expressed throughout the whole development, but it does not compensate for the loss of telling B. It's more important in single cell stage. Telling A is more important in single cell stage, whereas telling B is crucial for multicellular stage. And this shows that the common ancestor of all, probably all cellular slide modes existing at present, have already telling A and telling B. So these are five different species of which we have genome sequence. Nearly complete genome sequences. By the way, these are Drosophila and Sayona and mouse. Yes. Yes. Basically, it's very large, so it's a bit difficult. So complete compensation is very difficult, but you get fruiting bodies, small fruiting bodies. All cells make it. Although pre-stalk cells judging from the transcription, it seems pre-stalk cells make more, and it makes more sense. So, I should end soon. So, in addition to the local mechanism, so from these considerations, I would say, in addition to the local mechanisms involving actin polymerization, pressure flow of the cytosol caused by contraction of the cortical cytoskeleton, which I call the tail contraction mode, plays an important part in cell migration in dixostelium. Their relative contributions to cell movement vary depending on the developmental stage, physiological conditions and the environments of the cell. At the unicellular stage, the actin polymerization mode, which is something most people know, prevails. So that gives rise to what I call crawling movement. And actin filaments are dense in cytopodia in those cells. At the multicellular stage, the tail contraction mode is the determinant of the cell behavior, which I call gliding movement. In cells within tissues, cortical actin filaments are usually more densely distributed in the cell rear. While in the front, repeated, well, I didn't show this, repeated or continuous detachment of the cortical actin layer is very common. The reason that dissociated slice cells move this way is because cortical detachment of cortical actin layer in the front occur in that fashion, spiral fashion, like spiral staircase. I have evidence for that. So here is the model. Sorry. So within three-dimensional tissues, myosin-2-dependent contraction of the cortical cytoskeleton causes a forward flow of the cytosol, pushing the cells in its front. In the cell front, the cell membrane protrudes wherever the resistance is weak. So you don't have to wonder where to go. Just you push and then you will be led wherever it is easiest to go. So pseudopod extension by actin polymerization also occurs. Well, in three-dimensional situations, you can't have that round head because round things cannot fill the space. Instead, because the rear part, the cortex of the cell rear is more tough, more rigid because of a contraction, actin-myosin contraction. The myosin 2 is more or less localized to the rear. So because of the gradient of cortical tension along the anterior-posterior direction, if you put those cells in a box and press them hard, then what you get is cells in a shape of, I have some slide later, a round rear and sort of cup-like front. So there must be some pointed region in the front of the cells in three-dimensional case situation. Then in those pointed edge, pseudopod extension by actin polymerization also occurs. I think the curvature seems to be important, whether to make actin polymerization tip or detachment, as I said before. So the cortical actin layer receives then reaction force from the preceding cells and internal resistance force, which are transmitted to the neighboring cells via adaptor proteins such as TALIN B, and cell adhesion molecules and extracellular matrix. So these act as resistance to cell movement. Then these forces are further transmitted to the next cells, in the lateral direction, and in this way eventually to the surface of the tissue, next of the next cells. The tissue is embedded in a, in other words, the tissue is embedded in a large meshwork of actin filaments extending throughout the entire tissue. So this meshwork is not static, of course, because of the turnover of actin filaments within the cells. Of course, cells are moving, says continue moving forward. So such a mechanism would enable the cells to move easily within a tissue. So I'll show just one quantitative data, which I took more than 30 years ago. This is a motif. This graph shows the motif force, total motif force of a slug, migrating slug, plotted against the slug volume. So the total motif force is roughly proportional to the volume, meaning that those cells inside the slug, not just the surface, contribute to the motive force. So that indicates that cells inside must have means to get traction from the outside, not directly but indirectly from the meshwork of the actin inside the skeleton of the other cells. And animal cells can move in this way. Normally, people do not see this, but in early development, such movement seems to be common and described in old literature, like Trinkaus. And I also saw such movement in imaginal disc of butterfly. So I think this is sort of the conclusion. So I very quickly skim through the rest of the slides. So this is a graphical model. This is a cell, one cell. This gray line indicates lipid bilayer, cell membrane. This solid line is cortical actomyosin. So this part is thick, meaning this is posterior and this is anterior. And these dark dots are yet unidentified cell adhesion molecule, and this white bar is pastelin B. Then you can think of such model. This, sorry? Ah, that's a substratum. Substratum of that cell. No. Maybe the neighbor cells. Or this can be the surface. So if you pile such cells like this, then how they move? Well, this is just one of them. One cell, three-dimensional tract. I'm not sure if this word is all right. And rotating chikuwa. So if you know about Japanese food very well, you may understand what this means. This is a torus-like food. So you can think that such torus is rotating, and if you pile up those torus, then you can understand how internal cells can get traction from the outside. This doesn't hold in two-dimensional case like this. This is drawn on two-dimensional surface, and this doesn't work. If on the two-dimensional surface, this cell cannot get traction from the outside. But in three dimension, this part of the membrane is connected to this part mechanically, so that makes things possible. So this is a diagrammatic representation of the model. This is a single cell. In fact, those molecules will be will turn over this way, material. They will be released into the cytoplasm and come back again into the into the membrane. If you pile up such cells, you could get this kind of movement. Yes? Volume of the slug, volume of the tissue, is proportional to the number of cells. In actuality, as I said before, because of the higher cortical tension in the rear, cells should assume the shape looking something like this. All right. Well, I will not explain this. You could now argue about the mechanism of cell sorting, which I mentioned earlier. So whether this cell 3 can, by the way, from the shape, the whole thing move to the right. Whether the cell 3 move forward depends on the balance of force. This ridge. And chemotaxis in closely packed tissue will be a bit different from two-dimensional surface. This is the telling work was done by Tsujoka, mostly by Tsujoka and Yoshida. All right, thank you very much. Yes.
I have two questions, simple questions there. The first one is, why does the slime mold show phototaxis? What is the purpose for going in the direction of light?
Adaptively speaking, well, they live in a soil, in a shell, in a soil, but making a fruiting body deep in the soil would not make much sense, so it would be more better to.
But the same behavior is shown in petri dishes also.
Yes, of course.
And second question is actually open to physicists also. Does locomotion, is there any role of gravity in this locomotion, like our locomotion has a role?
If there is, it must be very small. You can see the effect of gravity by just standing the tissues perpendicular, but the effect is not large anyway.
Constitutively maintained at a constant level, or is it like it fluctuates a bit depending on different conditions?
In those experiments showing actually it's not actin, but actin binding domain used with GFP was introduced. So actin level will be the same as wild type.
No, I mean, throughout the life cycle of the cell, since locomotion is completely dependent on actin polymerization, so like actin expression is maintained at a constant level throughout.
Well, I assume that actin level should not fluctuate very much. And there are many actin genes, and actin promoters are pretty strong.
In the simulations you showed, what is the contact condition between your substrate and cells? And also, is it possible for you to traverse the substrate also along with the moment? Is it possible for you to move the substrate along with the cell, and do you see the same sort of locomotion? As in if your fluid
move,
is moving.
Move the substrate. Well, I wonder how to do it. Say they're sitting on a substrate, and how do you move it?
This is hydrodynamic simulation. Is this hydrodynamic simulations that you're showing?
That cartoons, that animation.
Right. Yeah.
I forgot to mention. That's not simulation. That's just moving cartoon.
In the slime mold.
Yes.
You mentioned after starvation that there are different signals. One for chrome sensing before aggregation. So, what is known about this signal? In the early phase of the starvation, providing quorum sensing.
The significance, you mean?
What is the nature of the signal?
Nature?
Yeah, what is known?
One thing that has been studied is the glycoprotein called conditioned medium factor, which is the it's a protein, and it has two different receptors for it, one of which has been identified. And it has many, many effects. Without that factor, cells cannot aggregate, so can't make fruiting bodies. So it must be very important.
But this precedes the signaling system by cyclic AMP?
It affects the which one? Anyways, it is required for the cyclic AMP signaling system to be built up at the right time.
So basically, the first set of factors tell the system that a critical density has been achieved, and then the cyclic AMP feedback sends it.
Does the gliding and or crawling moment depend on the type of substrator?
I'm sorry, I cannot.
Does the gliding vis-a-vis crawling movement be influenced, get influenced by the substrate?
Yes. if a gliding cell get attached to the substrate, it cannot continue gliding movement very long. It transforms to sort of crawling cells, a crawling cell. You get it? Well, it's not cell differentiation. It's just two different states. And the reason I used word mode is all the cells have at least two different capacity, different ways of cell movement, and the ratio of those two mechanisms. One more thing is that even within one cell, you can have both. If you look at vegetative cells crawling very carefully, you can see some gliding pseudopodium in it. Sometimes this you can. And as I said, within a slug, which are basically locomoting by gliding movement, shows actin polymerization mode in part of its front end. So everybody has both components, and the ratio depends on the situation.
Sylvia? So I have two questions. One is a follow-up of this. So is there a difference in the developmental stages of the proportion of cells that glide versus those that crawl? So are there patterns like, I don't know, at the beginning they crawl and then later they glide? And the second question is, I wanted to know whether there are experiments in which the speed of movement of the slag has been measured for different mixtures of cell types, so those that can glide or that can move and they cannot move. So you had mutants that could not move, and I was wondering whether the speed is proportional to the number of cells that can move, or it is proportional, I don't know, to the proportion, the ratio of the two.
For instance, aggregation stage is sort of in between vegetative and slug, Matsuela. So that's a transient stage. And cells look intermediate. Actually, I have not really carefully looked into aggregating cells because it's more straightforward to look at more pure state. I'm not sure I'm answering the first question, but if I can go to the second question, for instance, at Telin B knockout mutant cannot make slugs, but as I show, you can make stalk cells and spores of that mutant by mixing with Y-type. And the slugs consisting of 50% mutant and 50% Y-type move slow. And I did multi-force measurement, as I showed in the slide, and found that multi-force, total multi-force, was much smaller in those mixtures. So I suppose if you could mix vegetative, well, I haven't done this myself, and I don't think this is possible, but if you mix vegetative cells and slug cells together and manage to make a slug, then they will migrate much slower.
Maybe a last question from Bahram, and then we must take up. So if I'm going to get confused between the surface effect and the volume effect in the Chikugaba model you presented, if I take the same number of cells that you showed in your cartoon, but now I make them much more elongated, wouldn't I have much more bones?
How do you think?
In my opinion, I mean, the cartoon you showed, it seems that it's just this surface which counts. And if you take more elongated cells, you have more contacts. I may be totally mistaken, but you have more contacts per thickness.
With a constant volume, you can make the surface area much larger by, And, well, from an energy point of view, it doesn't seem to be possible to make them indefinitely stronger by doing that. Mechanically, I don't know.
Maybe.
I have to think about it.
Thanks very much for a superb